So we're in Daniel chapter 2 today, Daniel chapter 2, and we're going to be looking at, finally, third message in Daniel chapter 2. We're going to be looking at King Nebuchadnezzar's dream. And on that topic, as I was studying this week, I came across an article that was on the 14 most common dreams that people have. And how many of you think that you know some of the most common dreams? Any of you out there that are dream experts? All right, Rory, I'm assuming you don't want to come up here. No? Okay, so thank you for raising your hand. I'm not going to invite you up. Anyone else? Anyone else here? Now you know. All right, Xander, just come on up here and help us out. Yeah, come on up. I saw you all poking at each other. So here's what we're going to do. You come up. I'm going to give you an opportunity to guess three times. And if you get them in the top 14, then you win. You don't win anything, but you win. So come on up here.
This is the worst casino ever.
Here we go. So what would you say is one of the dreams, let me move this here so you don't see it, one of the dreams in the top 14 most dreamed types of dreams?
I'm confused.
So just being confused.
I was just poked at. I didn't know what.
All right, I'm gonna
I'm
just
not
make
a dreamer. Okay,
I'm gonna make an executive call and just go ahead and send you down right now while we're ahead. Richard, why don't you come on up here? See, Richard's a total extrovert, so he doesn't mind coming up and doing this. Okay. So what would you say, Richard, are some of the top 14 type dreams?
How about flunking an exam?
So flunking an exam. Hold on. Number 5, please. That is correct. Failing an exam. So that was the 5th highest dreamed dream there in that category. So you are one for one.
Can I sit down now, or? Am I in a roll?
We could do like phone a friend, but you're ahead right now. So let's say what would you say is another type of popular dream?
I used to dream about being run over by a train.
Well, unfortunately, that is not one of the dreams. Maybe that says something about what's going on.
I have one more shot.
But we will give it closely. Amanda, can you go to number 6 here? How about crashing a car? Crashing a car there. So that's sort of close there. All right, one more chance.
Okay. So for, say, popular dreams, I had one on the tip of my tongue, but as is happening more frequently, it just totally is escaping me at the moment. Yeah, so definitely, I used to have dreams of flying. Is that one?
That is correct. So flying at number 6.
It came back to
me. All right, so let's give Richard a hand here. He got 2 of the 3. So if you're curious here, let me go through the list. So the number 14 was hair falling out. And then number 13 was ghosts. Cheating on a partner, and then we have snakes. Here we go. Any of you dream about snakes? That wasn't really. Oh, wow. All right. Well, running late was probably a popular one here. We have unused room. I don't really even know what that means. Crashing a car. We have falling, and then we have flying. We have failing an exam, being naked in public, unable to find the toilet. I'm hearing some chuckling back there. Being chased. And then this number one here I did not get. But I'm thinking maybe this is what older folks dream about here. Teeth falling out. So I don't know. Is that true? So dreams here. So as I said, we saw at the beginning of the chapter that Nebuchadnezzar had a dream. And he was not happy about it. He brought in his interpreters. He had a staff of interpreters that he wanted to help him for this very purpose, to help him interpret the dreams. And so he brought them in, and he wanted them not just to give an interpretation because he knew that they might be guessing. He wanted them to tell him the dream first before they interpreted. And the king ordered that if they could not do this, they would be killed. Well, the interpreters got a little nervous because they said, "No man can do what you're asking." And the king, true to his word, because he's an honorable man, ordered them to be killed. And included in that group there, he wanted all the wise men taken out, was poor Daniel, who had been ripped out of his country and taken to Babylon. And now he was not even with that group at that time, but orders were given for all of them to be killed. So Daniel, as we saw 2 weeks ago and last week, Daniel steps in and asks God to help him interpret the dream. And God does that. And so he gives Daniel the dream and the interpretation. And so the rest of the chapter that we're going to be looking at today is what happens then from that point going forward. And so I'm going to walk you through the rest of this chapter, but we're going to look at it in two parts, because there's really two main messages that we're going to find in this passage. So we're going to look at part one, and then we'll look at the takeaway from that, and then we'll look at part two and the takeaway from that one. And so here's really the first part of the passage that we're looking at. And this is where we're going to get a glimpse of Daniel's humility. So we're going to start on, again, in chapter 2, verse 24. "Therefore Daniel went in to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and said thus to him, 'Do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Bring me in before the king, and I will show the king the interpretation.'" So Daniel here gets the dream and the interpretation, and he immediately goes to Arioch. Arioch is the king's captain, and he's been given the wonderful duty of taking out all the wise men of Babylon. And what is Daniel's message to Arioch? Is Daniel, does he go up to them and say, "Hey, look at me, I'm awesome"? No, his first action is actually to go and to plead for the lives of the other wise men. And so let's think about this. The wise men were probably not pals with Daniel. So they had different beliefs. And in the coming chapters, we're going to see that the wise men and other folks that are part of that group are not on Daniel's side. They cause Daniel and his friends a lot of trouble. And so why would Daniel then help them? And I'd say the answer is humility. Humility that Daniel didn't see himself as competing against them, as competing against the wise men. He didn't act like he was better than the wise men. So it was part of his character to treat these people and all people kindly. And so when God showed Daniel mercy, he simply took that mercy and passed it along to others. Now, a whole message could be made on that idea right there. Because God has shown us mercy. And what are we doing it with it? So we're going to go ahead and see some of this humility come out in the next couple of verses. But before that happens, we're going to see from Arioch's perspective a little bit of pride. So verse 25, "Then Arioch brought in Daniel before the king, and he said, I have found him. I have found among the exiles from Judah a man who will make known to the king the interpretation." So Arioch brings Daniel before the king. And notice what he says. He says, "Look what I found, king." Now, in reality, did Arioch find Daniel? And the answer is a big fat no. No, in fact, Daniel found him. As Arioch was going and trying to round everyone up, Daniel's the one that came up to him and said, hey, I got this. And Arioch here is showing this pride before the king because he wants to impress the king. So Arioch wants the credit here. But let's see how Daniel acts before the king. Verse 26. The king declared to Daniel, whose Babylonian name was Belteshazzar, "Are you able to make known to me the dream that I have seen and its interpretation?" And Daniel answered the king and said, "No wise men, enchanters, magicians, or astrologers can show to the king the mystery that the king has asked. But there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days." So what does Daniel do before the king? Daniel deflects the credit, and he says he can't do it. And he says that there's no human that can do what the king's asking. But then in verse 28, he says, but there is a God in heaven who can. King, I can't do it, but I know a God in heaven who can. And this leads us to our first takeaway. And so takeaway number one from this passage is that God works through humble people. And biblical humility can be defined as meekness or lowliness or the absence of self. So it's not thinking of yourself in like a below normal way. It's just not overthinking of yourself. So it's the absence of pride in your life. And so when you're humble, you're not overemphasizing who you are. And when you're in that state, you're in position to emphasize Jesus in your life. Steve Magnus is a performance coach, and he wrote an article about as a performance coach and as one who has trained professional athletes and Olympians. He wrote an article about the importance of humility. And so he believes that humility can actually increase a person's resilience. And so he talked about how when soldiers during training are dropped into an isolated forest and they're left there on their own, that when that pressure starts to build and when the stress builds, this is what Magnus said. He said, if they thought more highly of themselves than they really were, then they would struggle. And so if they went into this stressful situation with stress, like with pride, then eventually that stress would catch up to them and they would struggle. But if they had an honest assessment of themselves, they were far more likely to do better during these difficult times. So it was this humility of the soldiers that made them more aware and more there than more focused as well. And so he closes out by saying in this article, "We want our perception of the difficulty of a challenge and our ability to handle it to be realistic and overlap. When we go in with bravado, it backfires because the first inkling that we may not be able to succeed, our brain freaks out." So what I'm getting at here is that humility sets you up to be dependent upon God. And as I said last week, that is the best place to be. Not when you're dependent upon yourself or full of thinking that you can do it, but when you are holding on to God. And when you do that, that is the safest and the best place to be for you going forward. In humility, Daniel knew he couldn't fix the problem. However, he also knew a person who could fix it. So if Daniel had a life motto, it would be this: I can't do it, but I know a God in heaven who can. And I want to challenge you to make that your life motto as well. I can't handle this situation, but I know a God in heaven who can. I can't see any way out of this situation or of this health problem, but I know a God in heaven who can. I don't know how my prodigal child will ever turn to Jesus, but I know a God in heaven who can figure it out. Let's live with that motto in our life. In humility, realize you can't. In faith, realize God can. So that's part one right there. We're going to go ahead and go into really the main part of the passage where we're going to be looking at the dream and the interpretation. And we're going to first focus on the dream. And so let's now look starting at verse 31. You saw, O king, and behold, O a great image. In this image, mighty and of exceeding brightness stood before you, and its appearance was frightening. And the head of this image was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its middle and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. And as you looked, a stone was cut out by no human hand, and it struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them into pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold all together were broken into pieces and became like chaff of the summer threshing floor. And the wind carried them away so that not a trace of them could be found. But the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. Makes sense, right? We're good? We can go home now? When I read this the first time, I was like, huh? I'm clearly not gifted at interpreting dreams. And I want to try to explain just the basics to you here, because really, the specifics of the statue are not the main point. But the king was dreaming about a statue. And so the statue had four parts. So it had the head of gold. The chest and the arms were made of silver. The belly and the thighs were bronze. And then the legs were iron. And then the toes and the feet were a mixture of iron and baked clay. And so I came across a video on YouTube that sort of animates this. So let's go ahead and let's take a look at this here. And this will give you an idea. So we have the head of gold up here. And then we have the silver, the arms and the chest. And then we have the six-pack abs with the bronze. And then there's the iron legs. And under the iron legs are the feet that are mixed with the clay and the iron together. And so after the statue is described, we then learn about this rock. And this rock is not built out by a human. So the rock, we learn, strikes the feet, which causes the entire statue to break into pieces like chaff. Chaff is the, like those little parts of the wheat when you're threshing it. It just, they actually will blow a fan and it blows that part away. And so it's just the extra, the unimportant part that's just blown away. And so as this happens, the rock grows in size until it's then the size of a mountain that fills the earth. And I think this is where this part gets more interesting to me. And so in the next few verses, Daniel's going to give the interpretation. And so starting in verse 26 or 36. This was the dream. Now we will tell the king its interpretation. You, O king, the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, and the might, and the glory, and into whose hands he has given, wherever they dwell, the children of man, the beasts of the field, and the birds of the heaven. This is very similar to the authority that was given to Adam when he was put in the garden. The beasts of the field and the birds of the heaven, making you rule over them all, you are the head of gold. And so in this part, Daniel says that King Nebuchadnezzar and his kingdom is the head of gold. And as you noticed, as we looked at the different metals, it sort of goes down in value as you get to each part. You have the gold, and then you have the silver, and then you have the bronze, and then you have the iron, and then you have that mixture of iron and clay. And so the interpretation of really the rest of it is really just up for debate and speculation. There's people that have put all sorts of guesses into what the other kingdoms into what the other parts represent. There are other kingdoms, but the scripture doesn't say which one they are. And for this part of the sermon, it doesn't really matter. And so we know that the kingdoms decline in quality. But then the final part of the statue with that clay iron mixture represents a divided kingdom. And that is partly strong and partly brittle. Okay, so let's get on to what happens next, because this is the more important part. And in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed. Now remember, he told the king at the beginning that he's getting a dream that's basically a prophecy of what's going to happen in the future. And that shall never be destroyed, nor shall the kingdom be left to another people. It shall break into pieces all these kingdoms and bring them to an end, and it shall stand forever. And just as you saw that stone was cut from a mountain by no human hand, and that it broke into pieces the iron, the bronze, and the clay, and the silver, and the gold, a great God has made known to the king what shall be after this. The dream is certain, and its interpretation is sure. So after the different kingdoms that are represented in the statue rise up, there's a rock that's going to come out, and this rock is the kingdom of God. And this rock is going to grow and grow, and it's going to fill the whole earth. And so while the dream to our 21st century ears sounds a little weird, doesn't it? The message is clear. The message is that no kingdom is stronger than the kingdom of God. And no kingdom will last longer than the kingdom of God. And so this leads us to our second takeaway of the passage, that we need to put our trust and our hope in the rock and not in a kingdom. And so in this vision, we see a contrast between the kingdoms and between the rock. The kingdoms are unstable. They're there for a little bit, but then they're not. On the other hand, the rock is not going anywhere. The rock has no instability. Now, Jesus, actually, in Luke chapter 20, talks about Daniel chapter 2. And so I want to just mention this briefly before we continue on in the takeaway, because this part is important. In Luke chapter 20, Jesus tells a parable to a crowd about a man, an owner of a vineyard, who plants the vineyard and then goes away. And so after he goes away, he leaves some workers in charge of it. The workers aren't very good workers. So eventually the owner sends some folks to go collect the fruit. And when they do that, the workers there, the evil workers, beat them up and send them away. And this happens a couple times. And so after that, the owner says, I'll send my son. And so he sends his son, and the workers kill his son. And so because of that, the owner then sends a strong group of people that are then going to go and kill the evil workers and put the new workers in place that can do what he said. And Jesus here, in telling this parable, is illustrating that the workers are not stronger than the owner. They may think they had a hand and were more powerful, but in the end, the workers are the ones that lose here. But then, after telling this parable, Jesus looks directly at them, and he quotes from Psalm 118, and he says this: the stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. So the cornerstone, what in the world is the cornerstone? It's the first stone that's set in construction. And so it's the masonry foundation. And other stones are set in reference to this first stone. And so it's this cornerstone that sets the direction of the rest of the structure. And in this verse, Jesus is talking first about a parable and this vineyard and everything. But by this point, when he's quoting from Psalm 119, do you think he's still talking about the vineyard Or is he talking about himself now? He's moved on from the vineyard now, and he's talking about his own life. Jesus is saying that he is the cornerstone, that he is the one who is set first, that he is the reference point that determines the position for the rest of the structure. And then, in the very next verse, after quoting Psalm 118, he then says in verse 18 in Luke 20, he says, "Everyone who falls on that stone will be broken into pieces. And when it falls on anyone, it will crush them." Now, does that idea of a stone breaking things into pieces sound familiar? Jesus is referring to Daniel chapter 2. So, church, it should come as no surprise this morning. But let me say this. That rock in Daniel chapter 2 is Jesus Christ. And church, just as Jesus' kingdom is the only one that will last, any other kingdom is one that will not last. It is Jesus' kingdom that will smash all other kingdoms. And so I want this to be a challenge and really an encouragement to us. That first of all, if you've never put your faith and your trust and your hope in Jesus, you are trusting in the wrong kingdom. And that kingdom may be a country. It may be a belief system. It may be in yourself. It may be even a way of life. But whatever it is, that kingdom is not stable enough for you to put your trust and hope in. None of these kingdoms will make it to the end. Only Jesus' kingdom will do that. Sadly, though, those that have put their faith in Jesus Christ, many Christians say they follow Jesus, but then their actions show that they've put their trust and hope in another kingdom. So I want to ask you, church, what do you put your mental energy into? What occupies your time or your thoughts? So when something bad happens, when an injustice happens to you, where do you look for the solution? I want to propose to you here that the answer is not found in a political agenda. The answer is not found in culture's version of social equality. It's not found in drugs. It's not found in money. It's not found in pleasure. It is only found in Jesus Christ. Now, as an aside, having just said all of that, I'm not saying that Christians should only think spiritual thoughts and not care about their community and not care about equality and all of that. Christians should be involved in making the community better. Christians should be involved in politics, in equality, and social justice. We should care about those kinds of things. In fact, Daniel, who we're studying today, his main job was to work in the government. And so even though he's working in the government, he's working to make that government better, make no mistake, Daniel didn't put his hope in the government. And so may we, as Christians, have the same mindset as Daniel here. So keeping everything that I just said in mind, I want to challenge you all in two really opposite ways. And the first is this, that if life is going poorly, put your hope and trust in the rock. Now, some of you realize that the kingdom that you've put your trust in is not working. Some of you realize that life is not going well, that your hopes and dreams are feeling like they're being shattered. And maybe you feel crushed by the weight of life. Maybe you're feeling, or maybe you're sick. Maybe you feel isolated, or maybe you're disabled, and just life is overwhelming you. And if that's you, I want to challenge you to keep your hope in the rock. Because when life is smashed away, only Jesus will remain. But second, if life is going well, put your hope and trust in the rock. So we look at this passage. King Nebuchadnezzar, he had a good life. He had people serving him. He had all sorts of authority and power. He was doing really well. Things were going awesome for the king. But I don't want to spoil things for you. It doesn't last. And by the end of Daniel, there's going to be a different king, because the king that we see here, King Nebuchadnezzar, will be gone. And so it is dangerous, church. It is dangerous to put your hope in something that doesn't last. I want to read you what one commentary says. I think this is very helpful here. There will come a day when all of our little triumphs and glories will lie in the dust, and we will stand before the great Creator to give an account. And when that day comes, what will count will not be our standing in the statue, but our standing on the rock. And I think that last part deserves some emphasis. So here's your next point, if you have your teaching sheets. In the end, what will count will not be our standing in the statue, our standing in a kingdom, our standing in a belief system, but our standing on the rock. And so don't put your hope in this life. I read a quote from LeBron James. He's a basketball player. For those that don't know, I'm not a basketball guy, but he said this after, this is back in 2013, after winning two NBA championships. And he said, "What really got to me when we won the NBA championship was how short of a time it lasted. The championships last," and he snaps his fingers there, "just like that. The confetti rains, you go into the locker room, pop the champagne, and you do the media, and you have the parade, and then it's all over. It's over. You're looking around, and everybody's back to normal." And I was like, wow, that was unbelievable. That was an unbelievable 48 hours. I want it again. It was the best 48 hours of my life, and I need that again. And I have a drive that's burning inside of me, and I want to continue to be successful. It doesn't last. It doesn't last. Now, he would go on to win two more championships, and I'm willing to bet that he said the same thing about those two as well, that it was nice for a moment, but it does not last. So, church, we know what lasts. And so the question is, what will we do with that knowledge? And so let's hold fast to the kingdom that lasts. I want to close with a little story that I came across. I'm assuming it's not true, but it has a good point here. One afternoon, there's a man that was on a walk in the park, and he came across this Little League baseball game. And so he saw a boy in the dugout, and he asked the boy what the score was. And the boy responded, 18-0, we're behind. And the man, felt a little sorry for the boy, 18-0. And he said, boy, I bet you're discouraged. And the boy turned around to him, and he said this to him plainly. He said, why should I be discouraged? We haven't even gotten up to bat yet. And I want to encourage us, church. Life may be discouraging right now, but remember, God is going to have the last bat. And so don't give up. Don't lose hope. Put all of your hope and trust in Jesus Christ, because his kingdom is the kingdom that will never go away. So let's go ahead and spend a moment now in prayer. I'm going to ask the worship team to come on up.